Kia ora, Dee from Waipa District Libraries. Thanks for joining us again. If you came along to any of our Heritage Month events, you'd be probably familiar with the publication Plough of the Pākehā. Certainly a feature of one of the presentations that we had, which was presented by Roger Gordon and Greg Gascoigne. It's based on the book Plough of the Pākehā, A Cambridge Regional History by Eric Beer and Alwyn Gascoigne. And it was a publication written for the Cambridge Historical Society in 1975. One of our presenters, of course, Greg Gascoigne, was Alwyn Gascoigne's son. So I just thought I'd read for you the foreword to start with, and then we'll probably go on and share with you some other parts of the publication as well. 35 years ago, the Auckland columnist Kotare described the Cambridge district as a rich piece of the English countryside transplanted to New Zealand. Half a century or so before his day, the late James Cowan, historian of the Māori Wars, saw the town as a bare, windswept place sat on the edge of a wide, treeless plain. How Cambridge and its countryside evolved from such an unpromising beginning into a place of beauty known throughout both islands makes a story linked inseparably with the soil of this new land. It is a story of war and conquest, of pioneering endeavour and privation, told appropriately enough by two Cambridge farmers, the one an historian, the other a writer with a keen sense of history. For the past 12 years, Eric Beer, president of the Cambridge Historical Society, has spent countless hours gathering information from newspaper files, contemporary letters and journals, and other published and unpublished sources wherever they could be found. In the capable hands of Alwyn Gascoigne, author of From the Top of a Hill, this mass of material has been welded into as detailed and comprehensive a local history as any yet published in New Zealand. Since the co-authors themselves are farmers, much, but by no means all, of the history has to do with the countryside on which the obvious prosperity of Cambridge rests today. For this reason, it should be of interest not only to those who live in this favoured district, but to men on the land in all parts of these islands. After outlining the pre-Pākehā history of the district, the co-authors tell of the operations of British and colonial troops, which preceded the establishment of Camp Cambridge as a military outpost 110 years ago. They describe the failure of the military settlement scheme and of many of the large landowners who came after, and how the forebears of many well-known Cambridge families of today won through. The book is a worthy record of adaptation to new and difficult circumstances, dogged determination, and of adversity overcome. The authors bring these chronicles of Cambridge, that rich piece of rural England, to an end with the bells of St. Andrews ringing in a new century. One day, it is to be hoped, they will continue their chronicles from 1900 to the present day. C.W. Vernell. We'll be back very soon with more from Plough of the Pākehā. Welcome back and thanks for your continued interest in Plough of the Pākehā. Just going to continue with the introduction. Not the least fascinating speculation about a town is the question why it came to be there in the first place. For the sites of towns, like the sites of battles, are rarely a matter of chance. The choice may have been defensive, with a town gathering about a fortification, as we see so often in Europe, the ruins of a castle still dominating a sea of roofs. It may have been from a focal point of commerce, or a solitary trading post, from a resting place on a journey route, or from the ford of a river. In the case of Cambridge on the Waikato, the reason for its location is not difficult to find, for just above it the voyager came to the easternmost limit of navigation of the great river which gave the fertile basin its name. Here the smooth current was broken by the teeth of rocks above the mouth of the Karapiro stream. Miles further on lay Aniwaniwa, the ancient portage of the Māori tribes travelling back and forth from northeast to south. It was March 22, 1864, that the Kōhero with a military party aboard and making constant use of sounding leads, probed up the river as far as the present day site of the town. The boat was ugly and squat, loopholed for rifle fire and belched smoke copiously from a tall funnel. It was a crude enough vessel, knocked together in 6 weeks in Sydney, but it was a remarkable enough sight to the watching natives who had galloped down on horses, causing an unsoldierly panic on board and a hurried backing downstream. Prior to this, apart from the missionaries and the sporadic trader and merchant, there had been little European penetration into the area. The Waipa had seen more. What did it look like to those first European eyes, to such a man as the brave Anglican missionary, Reverend A.N. Brown, who first reached Maungatauri in 1834 with Richard Wade and in 1835 founded a mission station at Matamata? Today we know it is a land of verdant pasture grass, crisscrossed by neat hedges and marked by the rise of dark exotic trees. The guardian hills, sacred in Māori lore, Maungatauri, Porongia, Maungākaua and Kakapuku, these still watch the region, but 100 years ago their bush-clad slopes dominated a vastly different scene. Great swamps built up from blocked streams covered most of the districts we now know as Cambridge. They were heavy with flax and raupo, clumps of kahikatea and rimu bush breaking the monotony. Only the foothills of the ranges, the terraced land left as the river had cut its deep trench, and occasional hillocks rising from the swamps presented dry country. This was largely in fern and scrub. We have then a general picture of vast wastes of impenetrable swamps framed by bush-clad hills, of stretches of brown scrubland broken by native cultivation, rolling down from high slopes and ending as tongues of land in the flax and raupo. The river drained narrow tree-clumped plains which ran from the Karapiro stream north to Tamaheri and beyond. Even in the hill valleys, the swamps extended through the action of fallen trees and abandoned eel weirs, blocking creeks and rivulets. To the south lay a lake which early observers described as one of great beauty. This was Rotorangi, Lake of Heaven, partially ringed by lone fern hills. Occupying some hundreds of acres and then losing itself in the vast Moana Tuatua swamp, it was fed by the Mangapiko stream from the bushed backdrop of Maungatauri. Other vigorous streams from the foothills of Maungākaua, flooding easily, contributed largely to the formation of the Great Piako Swamp, which stretched from Taufari to Eureka and beyond. With so much water held back, the high banks of the Waikato were marked with many waterfalls cascading to the river below. The Karapiro stream, unimpeded by willows, showed clean, white, sandy beaches and ran much stronger than it does today. Through all the area echoed the cries of native birds, the weka, pukeko, the fern bird, and the lonely, booming note of the bittern. Such was the land, and the Māori had adapted its structure to his living needs. River-carved terraces, grey waki spurs, or volcanic andesite rubble ridges provided natural settings for defensive paths, lower terrace or streamed valley areas for settlement and cultivation. The region had long been heavily settled by native populations. Their fortified posts fretted the hilltops, well-worn tracks, hugging the ridges and skirting the swamps, led from pa to pa, the largest of which were Maungatauri and Maungākaua. Smaller villages were at Tamaheri and Taufari, where their hapū scattered over the entire area, the living sites determined by suitable land for cropping, the whole being the ancient and cherished stronghold of the Ngāti Hauā and the Ngāti Raukawa. The dense population was supported by the plentiful food from the swamps and bush and the produce of a primitive agriculture. From time immemorial, the natives had harvested this swampland, laying out their lines of hinakis, eel traps, at the outlets, and in the process of time, as they became choked and redundant with vegetation, succeeding generations would lay out new eel weirs, increasing the area underwater and greatly enhancing the source of supply. On the fertile land of the hills and plains, kumara were grown, later potatoes and wheat, reflecting the missionary influence. Modern research has revealed the unexpected extent of this native agriculture. It was a Māori practice to dig characteristic circular holes to obtain gravel for mixing with loam for kumara production. The material was carried in flax kits by the wahines and slaves and spread. The ground was then covered with manuka, which was burnt for potash. So thorough was this work that a new soil type was created, known today as Māori gravelly soil. Earth faces revealed in cuttings and excavations show this soil as a deposit on the original topsoil. The area so classified exceeds the extraordinary total of 5,000 acres of the Waikato. Well, we hope you've enjoyed that snapshot from Plough of the Pākehā and maybe inspired you to read some more. We'll be back with more Waipā history at a later stage. Kia ora.